Yeah, I'm John Carvalho. By trade, I am a sports media historian. My background is as a sports journalist, started in minor league baseball reporting for the Jacksonville Suns when they were the AA team for the Kansas City Royals, and like my bio says, would sneak players including Dan Quisenberry onto my parents' golf course where we were members. My main research has been on sports media figures who started out as journalists, and that includes Ford Frick, the baseball commissioner, and I wrote a biography of him titled Frick, Baseball's Third Commissioner, and I also have done some work, totally off topic, on Bill Tilden. And if I can take advantage of this, my card is Darren Dalton. Any Darren Dalton. Darren Dalton was like the annual darling of our rotisserie league drafts in the 90s that never quite panned out. This is part of a book project that I'm working on for Rutledge, a sports media history anthology. And if I can be honest with you, part of the discovery process, I offered my title when I proposed this presentation, and it was mentioned in my Frick biography, but I don't know that I'd call it Trapped in America anymore, because as we're going to see, part of the ambiguity of Masanori Murakami is that he actually kind of enjoyed his time in the United States and was pressured very much by his team and his family. But anyway, to begin with some background. Although baseball was introduced in America, it took on a culturally Japanese character in its country. In that country, when it was introduced, there really in every society that it was introduced in terms of its training and its orientation. As baseball spread, folks like Albert Spalding thought that they could use international expansion to expand their marketing as well. It didn't happen that way. It turned out in the late 1800s, throughout the world, more countries adopted British sports, like cricket and British football, because of its imperial dominance. Some countries, like Japan, adopted baseball and then made it their own. There were the tours, and referenced in the previous presentation, and this is a picture from Babe Ruth's participation in a 1934 tour, where he definitely won over the Japanese people. For him, it was also an opportunity to show that he could manage a baseball team. He was officially the manager of that group. The partnership between the United States and Japan in baseball fell off during World War II and in the run-up to it. But coming out of World War II, Douglas MacArthur, who was kind of the de facto occupational governor, though not officially titled that way, in Japan, and as we know, MacArthur was later a candidate to be commissioner of baseball when they selected Ford Frick, he saw that would be a positive cultural force in the recovery of Japan and in the mending of U.S.-Japan relations. So he promoted these tours. And in fact, in 1953, previously it was first minor league all-stars, then major league teams. In 1953, the New York Giants themselves began the tradition of actual teams touring, and that one, Commissioner Frick and his wife participated in that tour and even brought greetings from President Eisenhower, who also saw the usefulness of it. But by 1964, there really hadn't been an exchange of players. There had been American players at the end of their careers that had started, them going over to Japan to finish out their careers. Joe Stanka of the White Sox actually went over before his, while still in his prime. He didn't like the contract that the White Sox had offered, so he went over to Japan, and that caused some consternation. That it showed an uncomfortable level of player mobility for the major leagues. So they started an informal agreement to try to cut back on that, just saying that it would have to be up to both teams to approve of this. But in 1964, what actually, and at this point, is Richard Fitz here? Yeah, Robert, did I say Richard? I apologize. Because actually, Auburn University has a pitcher named Richard Fitz, who you'll see him later. I owe such a debt to your biography and everything, and I do thank you for the help there, and appreciate it. But Murakami and two teammates originally came over to the United States as part of a training program. And one subtext that emerged through this whole thing is that the Nankai Hawks, which was actually Stanka's team, and was Murakami's team, really didn't think that Murakami and his teammates were going to be that useful to them. So they sent them over here to learn. And then it turned out that Murakami was quite the find. As it pointed out, he was California League Rookie of the Year, had tremendous stats in the minor league. One columnist even pointed out that he could hit. He had 5 hits in his minor league career, and one of them was an inside-the-park home run, aided by the fact that the outfielder ran into the wall and knocked himself out, but still. And so he was called up to the Giants. Certainly appropriate that the Giants would do this. Horace Stoneham was one of the leaders of diversifying the roster, not only racially, but also internationally. He was he signed Latin players, Cepeda, early on, much more aggressively before others did. So it also stands to reason that he would participate in something like this. Another side story is that reflects that same attitude is that partially when he fired Alvin Dark, it was not just because the team had what seemed to be had plateaued, but also because Dark had shared some racist comments in a column about the Latin players, the African American players, and their knowledge and game management in baseball that had particularly upset Cepeda. So they brought up Murakami. And he had a great September. And he pitched 11 scoreless innings to start as a reliever. His time with the Giants ended up with a 1.80 ERA, and they definitely wanted to keep him there. Now, at this point, let me stop and say, the way that I'm going to look at this for my interest is I wanted to go back and look at how Murakami was covered in September 1964, then in February 1965, which point he was embroiled in a controversy we'll talk about in a second, and how that reflected cultural attitudes when it was positive and when it was negative, because we do find that sports journalists tend to be very transparent about those things, emotionally speaking, that affect the home team. I'm going to give you a spoiler alert, and that is that we're going to see actually pretty admirable restraint by the media in general, particularly the San Francisco media and even the sporting news. You'll see moments within the coverage. You'll see moments in other media. But in general, we see a positive here, and that is non-stereotypical coverage. Now, it had its moments, and including this cartoon from September 1964, where it shows, that's a samurai, I don't know if you can quite see it, on the pitching mound, and the batter appearing to be confused, not knowing how to take that pitch. But in general, the coverage was positive and very, very sympathetic. You know, noting Murakami's difficulties with the language and his efforts to assimilate to culture, but also toward his relationship with his teammates. Now, there were moments, like I said, you had this one column talked about the his fan club being called a fan crub and things like that. But those were in the minority. In general, especially in September 1964, Masanori was just a cause célèbre. The Japanese Giants fans even asked that the Giants have a Masanori Murakami Day, even though he had been with the team all of 2 weeks. And that's how it went until the offseason. In the offseason, there did come a controversy, and that was when, first, Murakami signed his contract for 1965. The Giants, as they agreed, paid a $10,000 transfer fee, and they thought they owned him. Well, then the Hawks began to claim that they didn't own him, that they wanted him to come back. The Americans said, well, we have a contract. And David Whiting pointed out in his book, you know, the Japanese view of a contract, what he called Nigen Kenki, looked at contracts from a relationship perspective, which was, if we have a contract and you're concerned about something, we'll work it out. The perspective, obviously, of the Americans is, if we have a contract, we have a contract, and that's it. And so those things came into conflict. And so again, at first, Murakami was much more positive about coming back. He pitched in the Instructional League and did well. And then finally, under pressure from his parents and from his team, he said he didn't want to come back. And again, that caused a real crucial point in American-Japan relations. We'll have our moment of Frick here. Frick was the commissioner at this time, and he, in support of his owners, as he typically did, you know, kind of stressed that Murakami had a contract, and that was the end of it. He had to show up, even to the point of saying that if he didn't, and even during this controversy, Frick declared that all Japan-U.S. baseball agreements were canceled or null because of their view toward contracts. Some felt that Frick was really mishandling the situation and making it worse than it was. I go a little easier on Frick, not only because his biography helped get me promoted, but because I think by 1965, Frick was really under a lot of undue criticism. He was at the end of his career. I think Frick's main problem was just that he was not Pete Rozelle at this point. And they could see what was happening with football. And so just about anything he did, they would say, oh, that, you know, that's just it. Did I disconnect something? No, it's right here.
So,
I tell you what, I always tell people, I have a PhD in this stuff, and I don't know what I'm doing. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know how to operate anything. How did I do that? I feel better. I know. But anyway, so by February 1965, as they were reporting this, not only, like I was saying, the Chronicle and the Examiner, but also the Sporting News, I was curious to see if they would introduce terms like Pearl Harbor, kamikaze, things like that. And interestingly, they didn't. The reporting was very straightforward, very informative. Now, it did, you know, obviously, the Americans support the American contract idea. The Sporting News editorial said, a contract is a contract. His parents might miss him. His team might miss him, but he signed a contract. The Nankai Hawks actually claimed that they did not sign the contract. They said that their team president's name had been forged onto it, and that they had a scout, Cappy Harada, who signed it on behalf of the president, and then he later stopped working for the Hawks, started working for the Giants. And so they said that was evidence that it was a forgery. Chub Feeney, Stoneham's nephew, the team president, said, either way, we've got Murakami's signature on it, and that's what matters. Murakami did not immediately come over. There was a lot of controversy, and ultimately when he did, it was really timed with the appeal from his father. His father, you know, simply said, this is my only son, I want my son home. And it's that really seemed to touch a heartstring within Frick and Feeney. And so they agreed that if Murakami would just play one more season and then could decide on his own if he wanted to play here or there, and that was how they would decide it. And he pitched in 1965 and then went back. But again, the reporting on it was very informative, very straightforward. And the main reason that I can give is that this was the San Francisco Giants. This was a Pacific Rim team. They were concerned about their readers, about the Giants fans. And they weren't going to offend them just to create lively reading. There was sensitivity toward that, as well as there was in the nation as a whole. Now, what this led to was the United States-Japan player contract agreement, and they finally did come to a more firm agreement that simply said they would respect each other's reserve system. So in terms of how did things happen after that, that's an updated photo of Murakami from 2015. As it pointed out, this created a de facto ban on players for almost 30 years. It wasn't until Hideo Nomo exploited a loophole, retired so that he could be available for the draft, and then was signed by the Dodgers, or said he was eligible to be signed by the Dodgers, that created a whole nother raft of issues that led to the 2000 posting agreement, which expanded, like I said, player participation, even though their options were still a little limited. I'm looking at this, and I think I'm running out of time. Oh, this says 113, and I thought, oh, my goodness. There you go. I like that better. So I'll slow up a little bit. So that's really where the debacle created this new system. That they actually worked under. And actually, I did that now. I'm close to the end, and I'm fine with that because I love to get questions from y'all. I just want to say that, like I said, this is actually a working copy of a chapter that's going to be in this book. And there's my email address. Like it says, questions, comments, and suggestions are welcome. I love presenting here, and I love presenting at the Baseball Hall of Fame because I find that it benefits me as much as them. In 2007, I presented my first paper about Ford Frick, where at the time we kind of were questioning his role in the integration of baseball. And I remember I had someone in the aisle saying, "How could you say that about Commissioner Frick? You're wrong." And it actually helped me. And so I will gladly send a copy of my paper where it's at to any of you guys, because I'd love to hear from you. And again, I'm looking forward to the questions that you guys are going to have, and the because I can always pass along to Robert, and any comments that you guys have. And in closing, War Eagle, the Auburn baseball team, made the College World Series this year for the first time since the days of Tim Hudson and David Ross. And I would also ask, are there any questions? Yes. I'd say that it was just, yeah, finally just giving into it. Wouldn't you say the same thing, Robert? See, look at this, it happened.
Oh, really? Yeah. And how would the, that's another question, that the whole history of the Japan is not a successful career.
And he really didn't have what you'd call a successful career. He had one really good year. And, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see because, yeah, he claimed that, that the American players were just not as picky about the pitches that they swung at, and that's what made him an effective pitcher, that his curveball, they swing at everything, and so he could really fool them with his pitches. So, yes. You know, that's a good thing. Was he with the Chronicle or with the Examiner? With the Chronicle, we looked mainly at the sports pages, and then we looked at the newspaper's editorial pages itself. We didn't look to Herb Cain. That's a good follow-up, probably, to look at. Not for this project. Robert did. You had a few. Yeah, but even though in September he was a hero for that, once he changed, I think. But wasn't that similar to the treatment of Nomo when he first left Japan? He was considered a traitor, and then he became a hero through the subsequent career. So, any other questions? Yes. He didn't have the mic. He said he pitched 18 years, and he had one, I think it was 18 wins that one year maybe. But other than that, he was a pretty marginal player. Oh, well, that's what he said. He was saying that toward the end of his career that he wanted to return. He kind of liked, especially the transition from the minor leagues to the major leagues. And I think the acceptance by his teammates was a factor there, too, as well, how they helped him to learn English and everything. So far from being isolated, and maybe that was because he was the only player, he was welcomed by the team. And he stayed for the instructional league. They were going to pay to have his, or they paid to have his tonsils removed when he went back to Japan. So he was looking forward to coming back because of that. So overall, he considered himself to be very well treated by the Giants and by his teammates and even the media. Yes. Okay. This is the last question, but I'll jump. Yeah. No, he.
That was part of the problem.
Yeah, in fact, that's what happened when he came to the. That's what happened when he came to the United States. Was they would be in spring training and they weren't throwing. And so I think he did his own throwing and even started out with shoulder problems because he threw too much in spring training and he had to rest. So yeah, the difference in training was definitely part of the adjustment. So thank you very much.